when the universe was half its current age, a very blue and very faint species of intermediate-sized galaxy thrived. We see them. They hail from a long time ago, representing galaxies far, far away. Their blue comes from the glow of freshly formed, short-lived, high-mass, high-temperature, high-luminosity stars. The galaxies are faint, not only because they are distant, but because the population of luminous stars within them was thin. Like the dinosaurs that came and went, leaving birds as their only modern descendant, the faint blue galaxies no longer exist, but presumably have a counterpart in today's universe. Did all their stars burn out? Have they become invisible corpses strewn throughout the universe? Did they evolve into the familiar dwarf galaxies of today? Or were they all eaten by larger galaxies? We do not know, but their place in the timeline of cosmic history is certain. With all this stuff between the big galaxies, we might expect some of it to obscure our view of what lies beyond. This could be a problem for the most distant objects in the universe, such as quasars. Quasars are superluminous galaxy cores whose light has typically been traveling for billions of years across space before reaching our telescopes. As extremely distant sources of light, they make ideal guinea pigs for the detection of intervening junk. Sure enough, when you separate quasar light into its component colors, revealing a spectrum, it's riddled with the absorbing presence of intervening gas clouds. Every known quasar, no matter where on the sky it's found, shows features from dozens of isolated hydrogen clouds scattered across time and space. This unique class of intergalactic object was first identified in the 1980s and continues to be an active area of astrophysical research. Where do they come from? How much mass do they all contain? Every known quasar reveals these hydrogen features, so we conclude that the hydrogen clouds are everywhere in the universe. And as expected, the farther the quasar, the more clouds are present in the spectrum. Some of the hydrogen clouds, less than 1%, are simply the consequence of our line of sight passing through the gas contained in an ordinary spiral or irregular galaxy. You would, of course, expect at least some quasars to fall behind the light of ordinary galaxies that are too distant to detect. But the rest of the absorbers are unmistakable as a class of cosmic object. Meanwhile, quasar light commonly passes through regions of space that contain monstrous sources of gravity, which wreak havoc on the quasar's image. These are often hard to detect because they may be composed of ordinary matter that is simply too dim and distant, or they may be zones of dark matter, such as what occupies the centers and surrounding regions of galaxy clusters. In either case, where there is mass, there is gravity, and where there is gravity, there is curved space, according to Einstein's general theory of relativity. And where space is curved, it can mimic the curvature of an ordinary glass lens and alter the pathways of light that pass through. Indeed, distant quasars and whole galaxies have been lensed by objects that happen to fall along the line of sight to Earth's telescopes. Depending on the mass of the lens itself and the geometry of the line-of-sight alignments, the lensing action can magnify, distort, or even split the background source of light into multiple images, just like funhouse mirrors at arcades. One of the most distant known objects in the universe is not a quasar, but an ordinary galaxy whose feeble light has been magnified significantly by the action of an intervening gravitational lens. We may henceforth need to rely upon these intergalactic telescopes to peer where and when ordinary telescopes cannot reach, and thus reveal the future holders of the cosmic distance record. Nobody doesn't like intergalactic space, but it can be hazardous to your health if you choose to go there. Let's ignore the fact that you would freeze to death as your warm body tried to reach equilibrium with the 3-degree temperature of the universe. And let's ignore the fact that your blood cells would burst while you suffocated from the lack of atmospheric pressure. These are ordinary dangers. From the Department of Exotic Happenings, intergalactic space is regularly pierced by super-duper high-energy, fast-moving, charged subatomic particles. We call them cosmic rays. The highest energy particles among them have 100 million times the energy that can be generated in the world's largest particle accelerators. Their origin continues to be a mystery, but most of these charged particles are protons, the nuclei of hydrogen atoms, and are moving at 0.9999999999999999999999% of the speed of light. Remarkably, these single subatomic particles carry enough energy to knock a golf ball from anywhere on a putting green into the cup. Perhaps the most exotic happenings between and among the galaxies in the vacuum of space and time is the seething ocean of virtual particles, undetectable matter and antimatter pairs popping in and out of existence. This peculiar prediction of quantum physics has been dubbed the vacuum energy, which manifests as an outward pressure acting counter to gravity that thrives in the total absence of matter. The accelerating universe, dark energy incarnate, may be driven by the action of this vacuum energy. Yes, intergalactic space is and will forever be where the action is. Chapter 5. Dark Matter. Gravity, the most familiar of nature's forces, offers us simultaneously the best and the least understood phenomena in nature. It took the mind of the millennium's most brilliant and influential person, Isaac Newton, to realize that gravity's mysterious action at a distance arises from the natural effects of every bit of matter, and that the attractive force between any two objects can be described by a simple algebraic equation. It took the mind of the last century's most brilliant and influential person, Albert Einstein, to show that we can more accurately describe gravity's action at a distance as a warp in the fabric of space-time, produced by any combination of matter and energy. Einstein demonstrated that Newton's theory requires some modification to describe gravity accurately, to predict, for example, how much light rays will bend when they pass by a massive object. Although Einstein's equations are fancier than Newton's, they nicely accommodate the matter that we have come to know and love, matter that we can see, touch, feel, smell, and occasionally taste. We don't know who's next in the genius sequence, but we've now been waiting nearly a century for somebody to tell us why the bulk of all the gravitational force that we've measured in the universe, about 85% of it, arises from substances that do not otherwise interact with our matter or energy. Or maybe the excess gravity doesn't come from matter and energy at all, but emanates from some other conceptual thing. In any case, we are essentially clueless. We find ourselves no closer to the answer today than we were when this missing mass problem was first fully analyzed in 1937 by the Swiss-American astrophysicist Fritz Zwicky. He taught at the California Institute of Technology for more than 40 years, combining his far-ranging insights into the cosmos with a colorful means of expression and an impressive ability to antagonize his colleagues. Zwicky studied the movement of individual galaxies within a titanic cluster of them, located far beyond the local stars of the Milky Way, that trace out the constellation Coma Berenices, the hair of Berenice, an Egyptian queen of antiquity. The Coma Cluster, as we call it, is an isolated and richly populated ensemble of galaxies about 300 million light-years from Earth. Its 1,000 galaxies orbit the cluster's center, moving in all directions like bees swarming a beehive. Using the motions of a few dozen galaxies as tracers of the gravity field that binds the entire cluster, Zwicky discovered that their average velocity had a shockingly high value. Since larger gravitational forces induce higher velocities in the objects they attract, Zwicky inferred an enormous mass for the Coma Cluster. As a reality check on that estimate, you can sum up the masses of each member galaxy that you see. And even though Coma ranks among the largest and most massive clusters in the universe, it does not contain enough visible galaxies to account for the observed speeds Zwicky measured. How bad is the situation? Have our known laws of gravity failed us? They certainly work within the solar system. Newton showed that you can derive the unique speed that a planet must have to maintain a stable orbit at any distance from the sun, lest it descend back towards the sun or ascend to a farther orbit. Turns out, if we could boost Earth's orbital speed to more than the square root of 2, 1.4142... times its current value, our planet would achieve escape velocity and leave the solar system entirely, We can apply the same reasoning to much larger systems, such as our own Milky Way galaxy, in which stars move in orbits that respond to the gravity from all the other stars. Or in clusters of galaxies, where each galaxy likewise feels the gravity from all the other galaxies. In this spirit, amid a page of formulas in his notebook, Einstein wrote a rhyme, more ringingly in German than in this English translation, in honor of Isaac Newton. Look unto the stars to teach us how the master's thoughts can reach us. Each one follows Newton's math, silently along its path. When we examine the Comer cluster, as Wiki did during the 1930s, we find that its member galaxies are all moving more rapidly than the escape velocity for the cluster. The cluster should swiftly fly apart, leaving barely a trace of its beehive existence after just a few hundred million years had passed. But the cluster is more than 10 billion years old, which is nearly as old as the universe itself. And so was born what remains the longest standing unsolved mystery in astrophysics. Across the decades that followed Zwicky's work, other galaxy clusters revealed the same problem, so Comer could not be blamed for being peculiar. Then what or who should we blame? Newton? I wouldn't, not just yet. His theories have been examined for 250 years and passed all tests. Einstein? No. The formidable gravity of galaxy clusters is still not high enough to require the full hammer of Einstein's general theory of relativity, just two decades old when Zwicky did his research. Perhaps the missing mass needed to bind the Comer cluster's galaxies does exist, but in some unknown, invisible form. Today, we've settled on the moniker dark matter, which makes no assertion that anything is missing, yet nonetheless implies that some new kind of matter must exist, waiting to be discovered. Just as astrophysicists had come to accept dark matter in galaxy clusters as a mysterious thing, the problem reared its invisible head once again. In 1976, the late Vera Rubin, an astrophysicist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, discovered a similar mass anomaly within spiral galaxies themselves. Studying the speeds at which stars orbit their galactic centers, Rubin first found what she expected. Within the visible disk of each galaxy, the stars farther from the center move at greater speeds than the stars close in. The farther stars have more matter, stars and gas, between themselves and the galaxy center, enabling their higher orbital speeds. Beyond the galaxy's luminous disk, however, one can still find some isolated gas clouds and a few bright stars. Using these objects as tracers of the gravity field exterior to the most luminous parts of the galaxy, where no more visible matter adds to the total, Rubin discovered that their orbital speeds, which should now be falling with increasing distance out there in Nowheresville, in fact, remained high. These largely empty volumes of space, the far rural regions of each galaxy, contain too little visible matter to explain the anomalously high orbital speeds of the tracers. Rubin correctly reasoned that some form of dark matter must lie in these far-out regions, well beyond the visible edge of each spiral galaxy. Thanks to Rubin's work, we now call these mysterious zones dark matter halos. This halo problem exists under our noses, right in the Milky Way. From galaxy to galaxy and from cluster to cluster, the discrepancy between the mass tallied from visible objects and the object's mass estimated from total gravity ranges from a factor of a few up to, in some cases, a factor of many hundreds. Across the universe, the discrepancy averages to a factor of six. Cosmic dark matter has about six times the total gravity of all the visible matter. Further research has revealed that the dark matter cannot consist of ordinary matter that happens to be underluminous or non-luminous. This conclusion rests on two lines of reasoning. First, we can eliminate with near certainty all plausible familiar candidates, like the suspects in a police lineup. Could the dark matter reside in black holes? No, we think that we would have detected this many black holes from their gravitational effects on nearby stars. Could it be dark clouds? No, they would absorb or otherwise interact with light from stars behind them, which bona fide dark matter doesn't do. Could it be interstellar or intergalactic rogue planets, asteroids, and comets? all of which produce no light of their own. It's hard to believe that the universe would manufacture six times as much mass in planets as in stars. That would mean 6,000 Jupiters for every star in the galaxy, or worse yet, 2 million Earths. In our own solar system, for example, everything that is not the sun adds up to less than 1/5 of 1% of the sun's mass. More direct evidence for the strange nature of dark matter comes from the relative amount of hydrogen and helium in the universe. Together, these numbers provide a cosmic fingerprint left behind by the early universe. To a close approximation, nuclear fusion during the first few minutes after the Big Bang left behind one helium nucleus for every 10 hydrogen nuclei, which are themselves simply protons. Calculations show that if most of the dark matter had involved itself in nuclear fusion, there would be much more helium relative to hydrogen in the universe. From this, we conclude that most of the dark matter, hence most of the mass in the universe, does not participate in nuclear fusion, which disqualifies it as ordinary matter, whose essence lies in its willingness to participate in the atomic and nuclear forces that shape matter as we know it. Detailed observations of the cosmic microwave background, which allow a separate test of this conclusion, verify the result. Dark matter and nuclear fusion don't mix. Thus, as best as we can figure, the dark matter doesn't simply consist of matter that happens to be dark. Instead, it's something else altogether. Dark matter exerts gravity according to the same rules that ordinary matter follows, but it does little else that might allow us to detect it. Of course, we are hamstrung in this analysis by not knowing what dark matter is in the first place. If all mass has gravity, does all gravity have mass? We don't know. Maybe there's nothing the matter with the matter, and it's the gravity we don't understand. The discrepancy between dark and ordinary matter varies significantly from one astrophysical environment to another, but it becomes more pronounced for large entities, such as galaxies and galaxy clusters. For the smallest objects, such as moons and planets, no discrepancy exists. Earth's surface gravity, for example, can be explained entirely by the stuff that's under our feet. If you're overweight on Earth, don't blame dark matter. Dark matter also has no bearing on the moon's orbit around Earth, nor on the movements of the planets around the sun. But as we've already seen, we do need it to explain the motions of the stars around the center of the galaxy. Does a different kind of gravitational physics operate on the galactic scale? Probably not. More likely, dark matter consists of matter whose nature we have yet to divine, and which gathers more diffusely than ordinary matter does. Otherwise, we would detect the gravity of concentrated chunks of dark matter dotting the universe. Dark matter comets, dark matter planets, dark matter galaxies. As far as we can tell, that's not the way things are. What we know is that the matter we have come to love in the universe, the stuff of stars, planets, and life, is only a light frosting on the cosmic cake, modest buoys afloat in a vast cosmic ocean of something that looks like nothing. During the first 500,000 years after the Big Bang, a mere eye blink in the 14-billion-year sweep of cosmic history, matter in the universe had already begun to coalesce into the blobs that would become clusters and superclusters of galaxies. But the cosmos would double in size during its next 500,000 years and continue growing after that. At odds in the universe were two competing effects. Gravity wants to make stuff coagulate, but the expansion wants to dilute it. If you do the math, you rapidly deduce that the gravity from ordinary matter could not win this battle by itself. It needed the help of dark matter, without which we would be living, actually not living, in a universe with no structures, no clusters, no galaxies, no stars, no planets, no people. How much gravity from dark matter did it need? 6 times as much as that provided by ordinary matter itself. Just the amount we measure in the universe. This analysis doesn't tell us what dark matter is, only that dark matter's effects are real, and that, try as you might, you cannot credit ordinary matter for it. So, dark matter is our frenemy. We have no clue what it is. It's kind of annoying, but we desperately need it in our calculations to arrive at an accurate description of the universe. Scientists are generally uncomfortable whenever we must base our calculations on concepts we don't understand. But we'll do it if we have to. And dark matter is not our first rodeo. In the 19th century, for example, scientists measured the energy output of our sun and showed its effect on our seasons and climate long before anyone knew that thermonuclear fusion is responsible for that energy. At the time, the best ideas included the retrospectively laughable suggestion that the sun was a burning lump of coal. Also in the 19th century, we observed stars, obtained their spectra, and classified them long before the 20th century introduction of quantum physics, which gives us our understanding of how and why these spectra look the way they do. Unrelenting skeptics might compare the dark matter of today to the hypothetical, now-defunct ether proposed in the 19th century as the weightless, transparent medium permeating the vacuum of space through which light moved. Until a famous 1887 experiment in Cleveland showed otherwise, performed by Albert Michelson and Edward Morley at Case Western Reserve University, scientists asserted that the ether must exist, even though not a shred of evidence supported this presumption. As a wave, light was thought to require a medium through which to propagate its energy, much as sound requires air or some other substance to transmit its waves. But light turns out to be quite happy traveling through the vacuum of space, devoid of any medium to carry it. Unlike sound waves, which consist of air vibrations, light waves were found to be self-propagating packets of energy, requiring no assistance at all. Dark matter ignorance differs fundamentally from ether ignorance. The ether was a placeholder for our incomplete understanding, whereas the existence of dark matter derives not from mere presumption, but from the observed effects of its gravity on visible matter. We're not inventing dark matter out of thin space. Instead, we deduce its existence from observational facts. Dark matter is just as real as the countless exoplanets discovered in orbit around stars other than the sun, discovered solely through their gravitational influence on their host stars, and not from direct measurement of their light. The worst that can happen is we discover that dark matter does not consist of matter at all, but of something else. Could we be seeing the effects of forces from another dimension? Are we feeling the ordinary gravity of ordinary matter crossing the membrane of a phantom universe adjacent to ours? If so, this could be just one of an infinite assortment of universes that comprise the multiverse. Sounds exotic and unbelievable. But is it any more crazy than the first suggestions that Earth orbits the sun? That the sun is one of 100 billion stars in the Milky Way? Or that the Milky Way is but one of 100 billion galaxies in the universe? Even if any of these fantastical accounts prove true, none of it would change the successful invocation of dark matter's gravity in the equations that we use to understand the formation and evolution of the universe. Other unrelenting skeptics might declare that seeing is believing, an approach to life that works well in many endeavors, including mechanical engineering, fishing, and perhaps dating. It's also good, apparently, for residents of Missouri, but it doesn't make for good science. Science is not just about seeing, it's about measuring, preferably with something that's not your own eyes, which are inextricably conjoined with the baggage of your brain. That baggage is more often than not a satchel of preconceived ideas, postconceived notions, and outright bias. Having resisted attempts to detect it directly on Earth for 75 years, dark matter remains in play. Particle physicists are confident that dark matter consists of a ghostly class of undiscovered particles that interact with matter via gravity, but otherwise interact with matter or light only weakly or not at all. If you like gambling on physics, this option is a good bet. The world's largest particle accelerators are trying to manufacture dark matter particles amid the detritus of particle collisions, and specially designed laboratories buried deep underground are trying to detect dark matter particles passively in case they wander in from space. An underground location naturally shields the facility from known cosmic particles that might trip the detectors as dark matter imposters. Although it could all be much ado about nothing, The idea of an elusive dark matter particle has good precedence. Neutrinos, for instance, were predicted and eventually discovered, even though they interact extremely weakly with ordinary matter. The copious flux of neutrinos from the sun, 2 neutrinos for every helium nucleus fused from hydrogen in the sun's thermonuclear core, exit the sun unfazed by the sun itself, travel through the vacuum of space at nearly the speed of light, then pass through Earth as though it does not exist. The tally? Night and day, 100 billion neutrinos from the sun pass through each thumbnail square patch of your body every second, without a trace of interaction with your body's atoms. In spite of this elusivity, neutrinos are nonetheless stoppable under special circumstances. And if you can stop a particle at all, you've detected it. Dark matter particles may reveal themselves through similarly rare interactions, or, more amazingly, they might manifest via forces other than the strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, and electromagnetism. These three, plus gravity, complete the Fab Four forces of the universe, mediating all interactions between and among all known particles. So the choices are clear. Either dark matter particles must wait for us to discover and control a new force or class of forces through which their particles interact, or else dark matter particles interact via normal forces, but with staggering weakness. So, dark matter's effects are real. We just don't know what it is. Dark matter seems not to interact through the strong nuclear force, so it cannot make nuclei. It hasn't been found to interact through the weak nuclear force. Something even elusive neutrinos do. It doesn't seem to interact with the electromagnetic force, so it doesn't make molecules and concentrate into dense balls of dark matter. Nor does it absorb or emit or reflect or scatter light. As we've known from the beginning, dark matter does indeed exert gravity, to which ordinary matter responds. But that's it. After all these years, we haven't discovered it doing anything else. For now, we must remain content to carry dark matter along as a strange, invisible friend, invoking it where and when the universe requires it of us. Chapter 6. Dark Energy. As if you didn't have enough to worry about, the universe in recent decades was discovered to wield a mysterious pressure that issues forth from the vacuum of space, and that acts opposite cosmic gravity. Not only that, this negative gravity will ultimately win the tug of war as it forces the cosmic expansion to accelerate exponentially into the future. For the most mind-warping ideas of 20th century physics, just blame Einstein. Albert Einstein hardly ever set foot in the laboratory. He didn't test phenomena or use elaborate equipment. He was a theorist who perfected the thought experiment, in which you engage nature through your imagination by inventing a situation or model and then working out the consequences of some physical principle. In Germany, before World War II, laboratory-based physics far outranked theoretical physics in the minds of most Aryan scientists. Jewish physicists were all relegated to the lowly theorist's sandbox and left to fend for themselves. And what a sandbox that would become. As was the case for Einstein, if a physicist's model intends to represent the entire universe, then manipulating the model should be tantamount to manipulating the universe itself. Observers and experimentalists can then go out and look for the phenomenon predicted by that model. If the model is flawed, or if the theorists make a mistake in their calculations, the observers will uncover a mismatch between the model's predictions and the way things happen in the real universe. That's the first cue for a theorist to return to the proverbial drawing board by either adjusting the old model or creating a new one. One of the most powerful and far-reaching theoretical models ever devised, already introduced in these pages, is Einstein's general theory of relativity. But you can call it GR after you get to know it better. Published in 1916, GR outlines the relevant mathematical details of how everything in the universe moves under the influence of gravity. Every few years, lab scientists devise ever more precise experiments to test the theory, only to further extend the envelope of the theory's accuracy. A modern example of this stunning knowledge of nature that Einstein has gifted us comes from 2016, when gravitational waves were discovered by a specially designed observatory tuned for just this purpose. These waves, predicted by Einstein, are ripples moving at the speed of light across the fabric of space-time and are generated by severe gravitational disturbances such as the collision of two black holes. And that's exactly what was observed. The gravitational waves of the first detection were generated by a collision of black holes in a galaxy 1.3 billion light-years away, and at a time when Earth was teeming with simple single-celled organisms. While the ripple moved through space in all directions, Earth would, after another 800 million years, evolve complex life, including flowers and dinosaurs and flying creatures, as well as a branch of vertebrates called mammals. Among the mammals, a sub-branch would evolve frontal lobes and complex thought to accompany them. We call those primates. A single branch of these primates would develop a genetic mutation that allowed speech. And that branch, Homo sapiens, would invent agriculture and civilization and philosophy and art and science. All in the last 10,000 years. Ultimately, one of its 20th century scientists would invent relativity out of his head and predict the existence of gravitational waves. A century later, technology capable of seeing these waves would finally catch up with the prediction, just days before that gravity wave, which had been traveling for 1.3 billion years, washed over Earth and was detected. Yes, Einstein was a badass. When first proposed, most scientific models are only half-baked, leaving wiggle room to adjust parameters for a better fit to the known universe. In the sun-based heliocentric universe, conceived by the 16th century mathematician Nicholas Copernicus, planets orbited in circles. The orbit the sun part was correct and a major advance in the Earth-based geocentric universe, but the circle part turned out to be a bit off. All planets orbit the sun in flattened circles, called ellipses, and even that shape is just an approximation of a more complex trajectory. Copernicus's basic idea was correct, and that's what mattered most. It simply required some tweaking to make it more accurate. Yet, in the case of Einstein's relativity, the founding principles of the entire theory require that everything must happen exactly as predicted. Einstein had, in effect, built what looks on the outside like a house of cards, with only two or three simple postulates holding up the entire structure. Indeed, upon learning of a 1931 book entitled 100 Authors Against Einstein, he responded that if he were wrong, then only one would have been enough. Therein were sown the seeds of one of the most fascinating blunders in the history of science. Einstein's new equations of gravity included a term he called the cosmological constant, which he represented by the capital Greek letter lambda. A mathematically permitted but optional term, the cosmological constant allowed him to represent a static universe. Back then, the idea that our universe would be doing anything at all, other than simply existing, was beyond anyone's imagination. So lambda's sole job was to oppose gravity within Einstein's model, keeping the universe in balance, resisting the natural tendency for gravity to pull the whole universe into one giant mass. Einstein invented a universe that neither expands nor contracts, consistent with everybody's expectations at the time. The Russian physicist Alexander Friedman would subsequently show mathematically that Einstein's universe, though balanced, was in an unstable state, like a ball resting on the top of a hill, awaiting the slightest provocation to roll down in one direction or another, or like a pencil balanced on its sharpened point. Einstein's universe was precariously perched between a state of expansion and total collapse. Moreover, Einstein's theory was new, and just because you give something a name does not make it real. Einstein knew that lambda, as a negative gravity force of nature, had no known counterpart in the physical universe. Einstein's general theory of relativity radically departed from all previous thinking about gravitational attraction. Instead of settling for Sir Isaac Newton's view of gravity as spooky action at a distance, a conclusion that made Newton himself uncomfortable, G.R. regards gravity as the response of a mass to the local curvature of space and time, caused by some other mass or field of energy. In other words, concentrations of mass cause distortions, dimples really, in the fabric of space and time. These distortions guide the moving masses along straight-line geodesics, the shortest distance between two points on a surface, though they look to us like the curved trajectories we call orbits. The 20th century American theoretical physicist John Archibald Wheeler said it best, summing up Einstein's concept as, matter tells space how to curve, space tells matter how to move. At the end of the day, general relativity described two kinds of gravity. One is the familiar kind, like the attraction between Earth and a ball thrown into the air, or between the sun and the planets. It also predicted another variety, a mysterious anti-gravity pressure associated with the vacuum of space-time itself. Lambda preserved what Einstein and every other physicist of his day had strongly presumed to be true, the status quo of a static universe. An unstable static universe. To invoke an unstable condition as the natural state of a physical system violates scientific credo. You cannot assert that the entire universe is a special case that happens to be balanced forever and ever. Nothing ever seen, measured, or imagined has behaved this way in the history of science, which makes for powerful precedent. 13 years later, in 1929, the American astrophysicist Edwin P. Hubble discovered that the universe is not static. He had found and assembled convincing evidence that the more distant a galaxy, the faster the galaxy recedes from the Milky Way. In other words, the universe is expanding. Now, embarrassed by the cosmological constant, which corresponded to no known force of nature, and by the lost opportunity to have predicted the expanding universe himself, Einstein discarded Lambda entirely, calling it his life's greatest blunder. By yanking Lambda from the equation, he presumed its value to be zero, such as in this example, assume A equals B plus C. If you learn later that A equals 10 and B equals 10, then A still equals B plus C, except in that case C equals zero, and it's rendered unnecessary in the equation. But that wasn't the end of the story. Off and on over the decades, theorists would extract Lambda from the crypt, imagining what their ideas would look like in a universe that had a cosmological constant. 69 years later, in 1998, science exhumed Lambda one last time. Early that year, remarkable announcements were made by two competing teams of astrophysicists, one led by Saul Perlmutter of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in Berkeley, California, and the other co-led by Brian Schmidt of Mount Stromlo and Siding Spring Observatories in Canberra, Australia, and Adam Rees of the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Dozens of the most distant supernovas ever observed appeared noticeably dimmer than expected, given the well-documented behavior of this species of exploding star. Reconciliation required that either those distant supernovas behaved unlike their nearer brethren, or they were as much as 15% farther away than where the prevailing cosmological models had placed them. The only known thing that naturally accounts for this acceleration is Einstein's lambda, the cosmological constant. When astrophysicists dusted it off and put it back into Einstein's original equations for general relativity, the known state of the universe matched the state of Einstein's equations. The supernovas used in Perlmutter's and Schmidt's studies are worth their weight in fusionable nuclei. Within certain limits, each of those stars explodes the same way, igniting the same amount of fuel, releasing the same titanic amount of energy in the same amount of time, thereby reaching the same peak luminosity. Thus, they serve as a kind of yardstick or standard candle for calculating cosmic distances to the galaxies in which they explode out to the farthest reaches of the universe. Standard candles simplify calculations immensely. Since the supernovas all have the same wattage, the dim ones are far away and the bright ones are close by. After measuring their brightness, a simple task, you can tell exactly how far they are from you and from one another. If the luminosities of the supernovas were all different, you could not use brightness alone to tell how far away one was in comparison with another. A dim one could be either a high wattage bulb far away or a low wattage bulb close up. All fine, but there's a second way to measure the distance to the galaxies, their speed of recession from the Milky Way. Recession that's part and parcel of the overall cosmic expansion. As Hubble was the first to show, the expanding universe makes distant objects race away from us faster than nearby ones. So, by measuring a galaxy's speed of recession, another simple task, one can deduce a galaxy's distance. If those two well-tested methods give different distances for the same object, something must be wrong. Either the supernovas are bad standard candles, or a model for the rate of cosmic expansion as measured by galaxy speeds is wrong. Well, something was wrong. It turned out that the supernovas were splendid standard candles, surviving the careful scrutiny of many skeptical investigators. And so astrophysicists were left with a universe that had expanded faster than we thought, placing galaxies farther away than their recession speed would have otherwise indicated. And there was no easy way to explain the extra expansion without invoking lambda, Einstein's cosmological constant. Here was the first direct evidence that a repulsive force permeated the universe, opposing gravity, which is how and why the cosmological constant rose from the dead. Lambda suddenly acquired a physical reality that needed a name, and so dark energy took center stage in the cosmic drama, suitably capturing both the mystery and our associated ignorance of its cause. Perlmutter, Schmidt, and Rees justifiably shared the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics for this discovery. The most accurate measurements to date reveal dark energy as the most prominent thing in town, currently responsible for 68% of all the mass energy in the universe. Dark matter comprises 27%, with regular matter comprising a mere 5%. The shape of our four-dimensional universe comes from the relationship between the amount of matter and energy that lives in the cosmos and the rate at which the cosmos is expanding. A convenient mathematical measure of this is omega, yet another capital Greek letter with a firm grip on the cosmos. If you take the matter-energy density of the universe and divide it by the matter-energy density required to just barely halt the expansion, known as the critical density, you get omega. Since both mass and energy cause space-time to warp or curve, omega tells us the shape of the cosmos. If omega is less than 1, the actual mass energy falls below the critical value, and the universe expands forever in every direction for all of time, taking on the shape of a saddle in which initially parallel lines diverge. If omega equals 1, the universe expands forever, but only barely so. In that case, the shape is flat, preserving all the geometric rules we learned in high school about parallel lines. If omega exceeds 1, parallel lines converge, and the universe curves back on itself, ultimately recollapsing into the fireball whence it came. At no time since Hubble discovered the expanding universe has any team of observers ever reliably measured omega to be anywhere close to 1. Adding up all the mass and energy their telescopes could see, and even extrapolating beyond these limits, dark matter included, the biggest values from the best observations topped out at about omega equals 0.3. As far as observers were concerned, the universe was open for business, riding a one-way saddle into the future. Meanwhile, beginning in 1979, the American physicist Alan H. Guth of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and others advanced an adjustment to the Big Bang theory that cleared up some nagging problems with getting a universe to be as smoothly filled with matter and energy as ours is known to be. A fundamental byproduct of this update to the Big Bang was that it drives omega toward 1, not toward a half, not toward 2, not toward a million, toward 1. Hardly a theorist in the world had a problem with that requirement, because it helped get the Big Bang to account for the global properties of the known universe. There was, however, another little problem. The update predicted 3 times as much mass energy as observers could find. Undeterred, the theorists said the observers just weren't looking hard enough. At the end of the tallies, visible matter alone could account for no more than 5% of the critical density. How about the mysterious dark matter? They added that too. Nobody knew what it was, and we still don't know what it is, but surely it contributed to the totals. From there, we get 5 or 6 times as much dark matter as visible matter. But that's still way too little. Observers were at a loss, and the theorists answered, "Keep looking." Both camps were sure the other was wrong, until the discovery of dark energy. That single component, when added to the ordinary matter and the ordinary energy and dark matter, raised the mass energy density of the universe to the critical level, simultaneously satisfying both the observers and the theorists. For the first time, the theorists and observers kissed and made up. Both, in their own way, were correct. Omega does equal 1, just as the theorists demanded of the universe, even though you can't get there by adding up all the matter, dark or otherwise, as they had naively presumed. There's no more matter running around the cosmos today than had ever been estimated by the observers. Nobody had foreseen the dominating presence of cosmic dark energy, nor had anybody imagined it as the great reconciler of differences. So what is the stuff? Nobody knows. The closest anybody has come is to presume dark energy is a quantum effect, where the vacuum of space, instead of being empty, actually seethes with particles and their antimatter counterparts. They pop in and out of existence in pairs and don't last long enough to be measured. Their transient existence is captured in their moniker, virtual particles. The remarkable legacy of quantum physics, the science of the small, demands that we give this idea serious attention. Each pair of virtual particles exerts a little bit of outward pressure as it ever so briefly elbows its way into space. Unfortunately, when you estimate the amount of repulsive vacuum pressure that arises from the abbreviated lives of virtual particles, the result is more than 10 to the power 120 times larger than the experimentally determined value of the cosmological constant. This is a stupidly large factor, leading to the biggest mismatch between theory and observation in the history of science. Yes, we're clueless. But it's not abject cluelessness. Dark energy is not adrift with nary a theory to anchor it. Dark energy inhabits one of the safest harbors we can imagine, Einstein's equations of general relativity. It's the cosmological constant. It's lambda. Whatever dark energy turns out to be, we already know how to measure it and how to calculate its effects on the past, present, and future of the cosmos. Without a doubt, Einstein's greatest blunder was having declared that lambda was his greatest blunder. And the hunt is on. Now that we know dark energy is real, teams of astrophysicists have begun ambitious programs to measure distances and the growth of structure in the universe using ground-based and space-borne telescopes. These observations will test the detailed influence of dark energy on the expansion history of the universe, and will surely keep theorists busy. They desperately need to atone for how embarrassing their calculation of dark energy turned out to be. Do we need an alternative to GR? Does the marriage of GR and quantum mechanics require an overhaul? Or is there some theory of dark energy that awaits discovery by a clever person yet to be born? A remarkable feature of lambda and the accelerating universe is that the repulsive force arises from within the vacuum, not from anything material. As the vacuum grows, the density of matter and familiar energy within the universe diminishes, and the greater becomes lambda's relative influence on the cosmic state of affairs. With greater repulsive pressure comes more vacuum, and with more vacuum comes greater repulsive pressure, forcing an endless and exponential acceleration of the cosmic expansion. As a consequence, anything not gravitationally bound to the neighborhood of the Milky Way galaxy will recede at ever-increasing speed as part of the accelerating expansion of the fabric of space-time. Distant galaxies, now visible in the night sky, will ultimately disappear beyond an unreachable horizon, receding from us faster than the speed of light, a feat allowed not because they're moving through space at such speeds, but because the fabric of the universe itself carries them at such speeds. No law of physics prevents this. In a trillion or so years, anyone alive in our own galaxy may know nothing of other galaxies. Our observable universe will merely comprise a system of nearby long-lived stars within the Milky Way, and beyond this starry night will lie an endless void, darkness in the face of the deep. Dark energy, a fundamental property of the cosmos, will, in the end, undermine the ability of future generations to comprehend the universe they've been dealt. Unless contemporary astrophysicists across the galaxy keep remarkable records and bury an awesome trillion-year time capsule, post-apocalyptic scientists will know nothing of galaxies, the principal form of organization for matter in our cosmos, and will thus be denied access to key pages from the cosmic drama that is our universe. Behold my recurring nightmare. Are we, too, missing some basic pieces of the universe that once were? What part of the cosmic history book has been marked access denied? What remains absent from our theories and equations that ought to be there, leaving us groping for answers we may never find? Chapter 7. The Cosmos on the Table. Trivial questions sometimes require deep and expansive knowledge of the cosmos just to answer them. In middle school chemistry class, I asked my teacher where the elements on the periodic table came from. He replied, Earth's crust. I'll grant him that. It's surely where the supply lab gets them, but how did Earth's crust acquire them? The answer must be astronomical. But in this case, do you actually need to know the origin and evolution of the universe to answer the question? Yes, you do. Only three of the naturally occurring elements were manufactured in the Big Bang. The rest were forged in the high-temperature hearts and explosive remains of dying stars, enabling subsequent generations of star systems to incorporate this enrichment, forming planets and, in our case, people. For many, the periodic table of chemical elements is a forgotten oddity, a chart of boxes filled with mysterious cryptic letters last encountered on the wall of high school chemistry class. As the organizing principle for the chemical behavior of all known and yet to be discovered elements in the universe, the table instead ought to be a cultural icon, a testimony to the enterprise of science as an international human adventure conducted in laboratories, particle accelerators, and on the frontier of the cosmos itself. Yet, every now and then, even a scientist can't help thinking of the periodic table as a zoo of one-of-a-kind animals conceived by Dr. Seuss. How else could we believe that sodium is a poisonous reactive metal that you can cut with a butter knife, while pure chlorine is a smelly, deadly gas, yet when added together, they make sodium chloride, a harmless, biologically essential compound better known as table salt? Or how about hydrogen and oxygen? One is an explosive gas and the other promotes violent combustion, yet the two combined make liquid water, which puts out fires. Amid these chemical confabulations, we find elements significant to the cosmos, allowing me to offer the periodic table as viewed through the lens of an astrophysicist. With only one proton in its nucleus, hydrogen is the lightest and simplest element, made entirely during the Big Bang. Out of the 94 naturally occurring elements, hydrogen lays claim to more than two-thirds of all the atoms in the human body, and more than 90% of all atoms in the cosmos, on all scales, right on down to the solar system. Hydrogen in the core of the massive planet Jupiter is under so much pressure that it behaves more like a conductive metal than a gas, creating the strongest magnetic field among the planets. The English chemist Henry Cavendish discovered hydrogen in 1766 during his experiments with H2O. Hydrogenous is Greek for water forming, but he's best known among astrophysicists as the first to calculate Earth's mass after having measured an accurate value for big G, the gravitational constant in Newton's famous equation. Every second of every day, 4.5 billion tons of fast-moving hydrogen nuclei are turned into energy as they slam together to make helium within the 15 million degree core of the sun. Helium is widely recognized as an over-the-counter low-density gas that, when inhaled, temporarily increases the vibrational frequency of your windpipe and larynx, making you sound like Mickey Mouse. Helium is the second simplest and second most abundant element in the universe. Although a distant second to hydrogen in abundance, there's 50 times more of it than all other elements in the universe combined. One of the pillars of Big Bang cosmology is the prediction that in every region of the cosmos, no less than about 10% of all atoms are helium, manufactured in that percentage across the well-mixed primeval fireball that was the birth of our universe. Since the thermonuclear fusion of hydrogen within stars gives you helium, some regions of the cosmos could easily accumulate more than their 10% share of the stuff. But, as predicted, no one has ever found a region of the galaxy with less. Some 30 years before it was discovered and isolated on Earth, astronomers detected helium in the spectrum of the sun's corona during the total eclipse of 1868. As noted earlier, the name helium was duly derived from Helios, the Greek sun god, and with 92% of hydrogen's buoyancy in air, but without its explosive characteristics, helium is the gas of choice for the outsized balloon characters of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, making the department store second only to the U.S. military as the nation's top user of the element. Lithium is the third simplest element in the universe, with three protons in its nucleus. Like hydrogen and helium, lithium was made in the Big Bang. But unlike helium, which can be manufactured in stellar cores, lithium is destroyed by every known nuclear reaction. Another prediction of Big Bang cosmology is that we can expect no more than 1% of the atoms in any region of the universe to be lithium. No one has yet found a galaxy with more lithium than this upper limit supplied by the Big Bang. The combination of helium's upper limit and lithium's lower limit gives us a potent dual constraint on tests for Big Bang cosmology. The element carbon can be found in more kinds of molecules than the sum of all other kinds of molecules combined. Given the abundance of carbon in the cosmos, forged in the cores of stars, churned up to their surfaces, and released copiously into the galaxy, a better element does not exist on which to base the chemistry and diversity of life. Just edging out carbon in abundance rank, oxygen is common too, forged and released in the remains of exploded stars. Both oxygen and carbon are major ingredients of life as we know it. But what about life as we don't know it? How about life based on the element silicon? Silicon sits directly below carbon on the periodic table, which means, in principle, it can create the same portfolio of molecules that carbon does. In the end, we expect carbon to win because it's 10 times more abundant than silicon in the cosmos, but that doesn't stop science fiction writers, who keep exobiologists on their toes, wondering what the first truly alien silicon-based life forms would be like. In addition to being an active ingredient in table salt, sodium is the most common glowing gas in municipal street lamps across the nation. They burn brighter and longer than incandescent bulbs, although they may all soon be replaced by LEDs, which are even brighter at a given wattage and cheaper. Two varieties of sodium lamps are common: high-pressure lamps, which look yellow-white, and the rarer low-pressure lamps, which look orange. Turns out, while all light pollution is bad for astrophysics, the low-pressure sodium lamps are least bad because their contamination can be easily subtracted from telescope data. In a model of cooperation, the entire city of Tucson, Arizona, the nearest large municipality to the Kitt Peak National Observatory, has, by agreement with the local astrophysicists, converted all its streetlights to low-pressure sodium lamps. Aluminum occupies nearly 10% of Earth's crust, yet was unknown to the ancients and unfamiliar to our great-grandparents. The element was not isolated and identified until 1827, and did not enter common household use until the late 1960s, when tin cans and tin foil yielded to aluminum cans and, of course, aluminum foil. I bet most old people you know still call it tin foil. Polished aluminum makes a near-perfect reflector of visible light and is the coating of choice for nearly all telescope mirrors today. Titanium is 1.7 times denser than aluminum, but it's more than twice as strong. So titanium, the ninth most abundant element in Earth's crust, has become a modern darling for many applications, such as military aircraft components and prosthetics that require a light, strong metal for their tasks.